History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And what we've realized is they don't have to go untold. If we'll just take the initiative to ask a few questions, and maybe more importantly, devote the time to patiently listen to the amazing answers that start to trickle back our way, we might just end up with some perspective we never would have developed otherwise. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we always come out ahead because not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we really are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The journey we're going to embark on together today has a few twists and turns and also some interesting connections. If you're a regular listener to Hometown Heroes, you might remember an episode a couple months back with a 99-year-old nurse named Betty Rosevere. In fact, she's about to turn 100 here the first week of June, and we'll celebrate with family coming in from all over. But before that, Betty will mark Memorial Day the same way she has since World War II, remembering her first husband, Billy Lou Huffman, a B-17 pilot who was shot down and killed over Europe. Betty joined the Army after that and served as a nurse in the Pacific, and as she gets closer and closer to that century mark, she continues to care for others, like her special friend Vic Walters, a Navy veteran of World War II who needs a little more care now as his vision and mobility continue to deteriorate at age 97. I had the privilege of interviewing Vic during the same visit with Betty in San Diego, California, and if you'd like to go back and listen to her interview, you can find it online at hometownheroesradio.com. Just pull up episode number 672. There's going to be another connection with Vic's story, which I was unaware of until just about the end of our conversation, but I'm going to let you follow along and explain it when the time comes. It has to do with the story we're going to hear on our next episode, a special Memorial Day weekend edition of Hometown Heroes, with a man on a determined quest to locate the remains of one of his relatives who was killed in World War II. 406,000 Americans died while serving in World War II. That represents about 2.5% of the more than 16 million Americans who ended up in uniform. And here's another number for you. There were about 110,000 service members in World War II who earned their American citizenship by joining our armed forces. Vic Walters and his brother were two of them, although they didn't realize it at the time. They had not been citizens until that point because they were not born in the United States. So let's start there, Vic, because from a chronological standpoint, there's no better time to begin than the time you were born. So why don't you start by telling us where it was you were born?
Elmont, Ontario, Canada.
And how long did you stay there?
About a year or two.
And your family came across the border and, yes. And ended up where?
We ended up going all over, but we ended up in Newton Junction, New Hampshire.
Where's that?
New Haven, Mass.
And New Hampshire's not the biggest state in the world, so I guess if you say what part of New Hampshire, there's...
Southern part.
Close to the Massachusetts border.
Yes.
Am I inferring correctly that that was a pretty rural existence?
Yes. They had one school there, and they had 4, 5, 6 grades going to the same school.
Does that mean you and your siblings were part of that?
Yes.
And it gets pretty cold in those parts.
Yes. Like 20 below zero.
Is that all? So you're growing up in the 1920s, and This is the period we know now as the Great Depression.
Yes.
Did you feel that? Did you have a sense of what was happening?
Yes.
What were the signs of that? How did that affect your life?
My dad wasn't making much money. We were pretty, very poor. I started going to school when I was 6 or 7 years old, 1930. And FDR became president in 1932. So we had 5 or 6 grades all in the same classroom.
How did you get to school?
Walk.
How far was that?
Oh, maybe 0.5 mile.
What kinds of stuff were you up to in high school?
Well, the first year I had algebra, and then the second year I had geometry. I guess I did okay.
How did you get to high school?
On a train.
On a train?
Yeah. My dad worked on a railroad, so I took a train from Newton Junction, New Hampshire, to Havel, Mass. Every day.
How far is that?
Probably about 8 or 10 miles.
Now, I've talked to people who walked to school, who rode their bikes to school, who drove a car to school, even some who rode their horses to school. I don't think I've ever talked to someone who took a train to school.
I took a train.
Did you get to become pretty close with the conductor of that train?
More or less, yeah.
Were there other kids doing that too, or just you?
Me, my brother, and my sister.
That was your special perk for your dad working for the railroad?
Yes.
And which railroad was that?
Boston, Maine.
Were you someone who was into sports or music or anything like that in school?
No.
Probably couldn't stay after school because you had to catch the train home, huh?
Yes.
Well, there's something that happened your senior year in high school that everyone that I've talked to who is alive then seems to remember. December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about that day?
I was listening to this radio program, The Shadow Knows.
Oh, yeah. Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
Yes. And while the program was going on, it stopped and said, the Japanese have bombed Pearl Harbor today. And I remember that. I'll never forget that. So I was a senior then. So the next morning, they had FDR on there talking about the dastardly attack and so forth and so on. So I knew what my future was, because I was 18 and the war was on. So I was going.
Is that something where you guys were in school the next day and they called you all in to listen to FDR?
Yes, we heard him talk.
What kind of impression did that make on an 18-year-old kid?
I knew that I was going to war as soon as I graduated.
And I imagine some of your classmates were probably talking about doing the same thing?
Yeah, more or less, yeah.
So did you weigh some different options for how you might serve your country?
My brother was 17 then, and he was really eager to get in the armed forces, but I wasn't. Anyway, he decided. This was June 4th, 1942. He said, let's join the Navy. So we did. We went down, and they said, okay, come down in a couple days, and we'll take you down to Boston and get you in the Navy. And we went to boot camp. We were supposed to go 12 weeks, but we only went 5 weeks. So I took a test and so forth, and I guess I must have done pretty good, because when we finished after 5 weeks, he went down to Jacksonville, Florida, and so did I. So he went to radio school, and I went to Aviation Machinist Mate School. So on the weekend, we'd go out to Jacksonville Beach. And the first day we went out there, this was about the time that they had caught some German saboteurs.
Mm.
So they asked him, where was you born and so forth? So they must have questioned him for half an hour, more or less. And I told him, I said, the next time we'll go, they asked you where you were born, just say Newton, New Hampshire. So he did. So we used to go out there. I went to school about 6 months, and he went about maybe 5 months. And then when he was finished school, they said, do you want to be an aerial gunner? So he did. So when I finished school, I did the same. So I went to gunnery school at Yellowwater, Jacksonville, for about a month and so forth. And after that, you became an aerial gunner.
Mm-hmm.
And you stayed that the rest of the war.
And I've got some questions about that. But before I ask you those questions, I try to put myself in your shoes. So here you've got two brothers, 18 and 17. You're both signing up for the Navy in the first 6 months of the war here.
Yeah.
For your brother to go in, your parents had to sign for him, right?
Yes.
How did your parents feel about their only two sons going off to war?
I guess they felt, you know, that's the way it's going to be, because my dad was in the Canadian Army in World War One.
Did he ever tell you anything about what that was like?
Yes. He didn't go over to the trenches. He stayed in England.
Well, I imagine if he had gone over to the trenches, you might not be here.
Yes, that's very true.
So he supported both of you signing up for the Navy.
Yes.
And you have all this training in Florida.
Yeah.
And what you were saying about the German saboteurs, you're saying so they were questioning everyone about origins?
They really questioned. They questioned him for about 15 minutes. And I told them, I said, the next time when they ask you where you were born, just say Newton, New Hampshire. And I always used to say that.
So just to be clear, it wasn't a suspected saboteur you were giving that advice to, but it was your younger brother, since you were both born in Canada, coming up with an alternate answer for that place of birth, which really wasn't too far from the truth, would negate some of that suspicion, I suppose. But as far as aerial gunnery school, what was that like?
It was only a month.
Uh-huh.
So after that, you became an aerial gunner. So I got in this seaplane squadron, VP-81, and they sent us up to Elizabeth City, North Carolina, and we stayed up there for a few days. And I remember they gave this pilot this award. He had dropped a bomb. He thought it was a submarine, but it was a whale. He got a whale banger award.
That's the first I've ever heard of that award, Vic.
Me too, yeah.
And what was your brother's name?
Les.
Les?
You called him Les, yeah.
And so you two, and this is early in the war, this is long before the Sullivan brothers are all killed on the USS Juno.
Yeah.
So brothers are still allowed to serve together at this time.
Yes.
And you guys actually stayed together for quite some time, through training anyway, right?
Through training, yeah.
But when you went to Elizabeth City, where did he go?
He went to somewhere in Florida. He got on one of these, a small aircraft carrier. So he was down in New Jersey, I think, and I met his crew and so forth. So I didn't see him. So I'm out there a year or so later at Pearl Harbor, and here comes this small carrier in, and damned if it wasn't his. So it pulled up into the dock there, you know, and they put the gangplanks down, and the first guy down the gangplank was my brother with a toolbox. The crew had met me, and they were surprised to see me and so forth. But anyway, they took the plane off, and they were flying around Pearl Harbor. You know how Honolulu is? It's raining all the time.
Right.
So I made a couple flights with him, and then he took off. So his carrier, small carrier, went along with the big carriers. They were smaller, but yet they could do 30 miles an hour. So he saw quite a bit of action there. And there was he had a picture of where this something had gone through the back of the wing of his plane. And if it had gone through the front, it would have cut the wing right off.
Oof. So when you said you got to go up with him in Pearl Harbor and fly around, what were you flying in?
In his plane.
In his plane.
They took his plane off the carrier.
Uh-huh.
So they were, took a couple flights with him.
I don't think too many brothers get to do that in the middle of a war.
No.
Who were you more concerned for, yourself or your little brother?
Neither one of us. Because once you went to gunnery school, you were aerial gunner the rest of the war.
That wasn't the safest job in the war, Vic.
It wasn't, but that's what we decided to do.
Mm-hmm. So he was in this squadron on an aircraft carrier, but you said you were sent to a seaplane squadron. So is this PBY Catalinas, or what were you working with?
Yes, PBY Catalinas.
And how many men are on the crew for one of those?
Oh, about 10.
And where would you be?
I was they had two engines, so I took care of the engine. I became a plane captain eventually. We were on seaplanes, but we also had landing gear. So we were out in the Solomons and so forth. So we used to fly around all the time. But anyway, when we were on land, we were just flying around with wheels on us.
Mm-hmm. But if you needed to land on water or take off on water, you could.
Yes. And we did, yeah. We were up there one day. And so they told me, said, hey, go with this plane. And so we did. We went up to Bougainville. So they decided we didn't have any place to put our bombs. So they took the fuses out and dropped them on the ground. So anyway, we were there a couple of days. And up comes Admiral Halsey. So anyway, we took off from Bougainville, and we landed in a lagoon on Green Island. And the Marines had landed on Green Island, so Halsey found out that the natives had told the Japanese that the Americans were coming in. We wanted to capture some Japanese and talk to them, but by the time we got there, the Japanese were all gone. And so Halsey found out that the natives had helped the Japanese. So he told us, he said, "You guys stay right here and here." And he said, "The natives are coming off, and don't help them." And I remember one of the guys come off, he had a bad knee or something. So he told us, he said, "You guys stand here and here, and don't help the natives. Don't help the natives get off." So we did. We just stood there. And so they took all the natives and took them right past us and put them on a ship and sent them off immediately. So we stayed there during the daytime. I thought we were going to stay there overnight. I didn't want to stay there. But anyway, we got on a plane and flew back. And while we were flying back, I remember there was fighter planes going past us both ways all the time. We flew past the place where Yamamoto had been shot down.
That squadron of P-38s tracked him down and shot him down.
Yes.
So that's what that air traffic was?
Yeah.
And if you're a regular listener to Hometown Heroes, maybe that rings a bell for you, because we have had a few folks who were involved in that moment share their stories here. It was called Operation Vengeance. Isoroku Yamamoto was the admiral seen as the mastermind behind Imperial Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. And a year and a half later, because of efforts to intercept and decipher Japanese code, the Allies had detailed knowledge of Yamamoto's movements. In April 1943, 18 P-38s took off on the mission of shooting down the enemy bomber carrying Yamamoto. Vic Walters did not see that bomber's final moments, but 2 years later, he would see a bomber shot down, and he came incredibly close to having his own plane taken out. We're going to find out why June 1st, 1945 is a day he will never forget when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.